Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If you hadn't noticed, you're not looking. We live in the era of pervasive cosmetic surgery. Everybody nipped and tucked and Botoxed and liposucked to a fare-thee-well. Well, not everybody. But look around at the trout pout lips and wind tunnel facelifts, the kabuki zone of expressionless brows, the gravity-defying fronts and rears and rows of paint-white teeth, and you know it's a full-bodied job site out there. Alex Kuczynski started when she was 27 and didn't stop nipping and pumping for 10 years. Couldn't stop. Now she's telling her story and much of the country's. Up next on Point, addicted to the next procedure, tales of a cosmetic surgery junkie. Joining me now from New York is Alex Kuczynski. She is a styles section columnist at the New York Times, a former New York Times reporter. Her new book is called Beauty Junkies, Inside Our $15 billion Obsession with Cosmetic Surgery. Alex Kuczynski, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thanks. Hi, Tom.
Hi. So here we are. Talk about an intimate tour of the boardwalk. You take us way in on your own experience and that a lot of others, and then your own all over again. And I guess I want to start by asking you, you know, cosmetic surgery has been out there as a fact and as a laugh line and a joke and probably even some kind of obsession for a long time now. You're describing a sort of new frontier where it's going even further, getting even more ingrained in the culture. Take us out to that frontier. How obsessed are people? Where are the new procedures going? What's the far reach here that you're pointing to?
Well, there are a lot of things that have led to this incredible boom in elective plastic surgery. And it's not just our vanity. I mean, a lot of people like to say, I blame society. I blame celebrity. You know, we all want to look like Pamela Anderson or, you know, the East Coast version of her, which might be a little less excessive. But the truth is that the way that health insurance and the way that doctors manage their offices has led us partly into this obsession with the way we look.
But health insurance doesn't cover most of this stuff, right?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't cover any elective cosmetic surgery. And so lots of doctors who, let's say you're an ophthalmologist, you know, you can hang out a shingle that says, you know, I'm an MD and now I'm a cosmetic surgeon. So come to me. I've taken a weekend course at the Hilton in liposuction.
Wait a minute. An ophthalmologist that is an eye doctor can start sucking fat out of your rear?
Yeah, absolutely. It's completely legal. Anyone with an MD and, in fact, anyone with a DDS degree, an oral surgeon or a dentist in several states can now practice cosmetic surgery. But it doesn't work the other way around.
Meaning?
Let's say I'm a plastic surgeon, and I've been board certified by the American Board of Plastic Surgery, which is the sort of governing body. You can't hang out a shingle and say, come to me for your cornea surgery, because insurance companies cover that. And your insurance company would step in and say, wait a second, what are you doing? We're not paying for this.
But wait a minute. You're pointing then, I mean, we understand then, I guess you're saying doctors have a financial incentive to get out of the health insurance world where all their reimbursement is tightly controlled, to get out into the cosmetic surgery world where they can charge whatever the market will bear. But is that – and I can see how that would contribute. It would make doctors eager to do it and maybe eager to encourage it. But is that really what's driving this tidal wave of procedures you're talking about?
It's part of the perfect storm. You know, I would say it's one of the waves that's contributing to this, you know, tornado of obsession. I mean, certainly I think celebrity and our culture of celebrity plays a big part in this. I mean, we receive images of perfect celebrity bodies in so many different platforms today, you know, on our iPods, through television, TiVo, our PDAs, our telephones. It's kind of difficult to walk through the day without seeing at least, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 images of ideal masculine and feminine beauty and then stop to wonder about ourselves.
Here you were, 27 years old, when you got into this, into a sort of decade of cosmetic surgery. Now, I've in all the materials here, I see several photographs of you. You're a nice-looking mm-hmm. woman. I bet at 27, you were turning heads just fine. So what got you on the cosmetic surgery bandwagon?
You know, I was writing about cosmetic surgical procedures for the style section of the New York Times and previously for the New York Observer. And, you know, every time I interviewed a plastic surgeon, at the end of the interview, I would say, and by the way, doc, anything I should get done? And they would all take their pencil with the little eraser end and pull my upper eyelids up and say, I would definitely get rid of the Charlotte Rampling look.
A little puffiness in that upper lip.
A little puffiness. So I thought, you know, gosh, I've researched all these doctors. I know who the best ones are, you know, and I decided to do that. And that was after I had already dabbled a bit in Botox.
But you were 27. You know, I mean, you're still almost a baby at 27. Botox and
it's shocking. It's really surprising, but the way that the medical community, or not everyone certainly, but a lot of doctors offer Botox and, you know, smaller surgical procedures as what they call a prophylactic measure against future aging. You know, they encourage you to come in at younger and younger ages. And actually, fascinatingly, having had Botox for on a regular basis for about 10 years.
Yeah.
I've been Botox-free for a year now, and I expected a lot more animation in my face than I have.
What, do you think you killed it off? Is it all done? You just lost it?
I think that you know, those poor little muscles that create the tiny little wrinkles in my forehead were paralyzed for so long. They're struggling. They're, like, working out to come back, and
Botox
it's taking
free,
them a long time.
Right, but it's not coming back. Yeah. Take us down that laundry list. Here we're talking the decade from 27 to 38 or so. Mm-hmm. What all did you get done?
Lots of Botox.
Forehead, around the eyes, where?
Forehead, around the eyes, upper forehead. That's really it.
At one point, you even asked the doctor to do it in your neck, and she said it's
I asked her to do it in my neck once, and she said, don't be crazy, my God. I had a wonderful plastic surgeon in New York as a woman, and very judicious.
Right.
And she said, God, don't be insane. You're 29 years old.
Botox is the baseline. What else went?
Yeah. Then I had trained for the New York City Marathon. And I ran it in a reasonably good time. And, you know, I finished the race and I got my medal. And I thought, but why do I still have these tiny little, you know, teaspoonfuls of jiggling fat on the sides of my legs that the industry so indelicately refers to as saddlebags?
Mm.
And so this little, you know, bell went off in my head. And I went off to Dr. Michelle, as I call her, and had a little liposuction.
Your thighs and your rear end,
It's really, you know, you're a man, so you don't know what saddlebags are, but they're women know what they are, and they're sort of, it's somewhere between your bottom and your upper thigh.
All right, so Botox,
and
liposuction.
Eyes.
Yeah, eyes.
And then, you know, I dabbled in a little collagen and then in the nasolabial folds, are the lines that run from the nose to the mouth.
What, the two little ridges there from nose to mouth? You wanted them more prominent?
You know, actually, no, I just sort of filled them in so that they would, like, create the look of a younger person. And, and, you know, there are all sorts of fillers one can use. I mean, we tried things from, you know, collagen derived from cadavers to, you know, the collagen that is grown in an enormous football-sized petri dish of collagen that's derived from one little boy's fetal foreskin cells. And, you know, it's quite amazing the amount of stuff I put in my face.
Yeah.
And then my last sort of tango was with a new filler, which is a synthetic form of hyaluronic acid, which is organically found in rooster combs. And this is a kind of a hot new substance that people are using
this
to put in their faces.
This is Restylane, if I've got it right.
Restylane, yeah.
Restylane. And this went into your lip or lips?
This went into my upper lip. And, you know, my lips are fine. So at this point, I remember I had gone to the funeral of one of my best friends. This is a very, very bad story. But I hope he's laughing about it now, wherever he is. Mm. And on the way to the reception, I kept my appointment to have the Restylane injected into my lip.
Between the funeral service and the sort of memorial reception.
Yeah. And I said, you know, I'll look great. You know, I'll make a toast and I'll have great big lips when I do it. I had a driver. I had it all sort of arranged with the precision of a military operation. Pulled up to the doctor's office, said, okay, let's do it. She said, great, fine, here we go. Ba, 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 da, da, da. Iced my lip. And then, you know, 5 minutes later, something felt kind of wrong. And I opened the door to the treatment room and I walked out. And there was a young nurse there who had just started, and she was carrying a tray of implements. And she looked at me and said, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God, and threw her tray in the air and then ran around the corner. And I thought, something's very wrong. And my lip had indeed swollen to the size of a yam. So I couldn't speak. I couldn't bring my lips together to speak. And I wound up spending 4 days at home, frequently applying steroid cream and taking steroids so that the swelling would go down. And in the end, all the skin, which had been stretched to these enormous proportions on my upper lip, sheared off in thin little slivers. And it was, as they say in the industry, not a good result.
The lady in black with a lip like a large yam, you write. And there, the beginning of you pulling out of your decade-long practically obsession with cosmetic surgery. Let's take a call from Boston. Saul is on the line. Hi, Saul. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you know?
Well, I used to be a surgeon. I'm retired now, but I was listening to this lady, the story that he was telling, and especially when she had a problem or somebody died and went to cosmetic surgery.
Yeah.
That shows what I was going to discuss. 99% of the people who go with unnecessary cosmetic surgery, they have psychiatric problems.
Psychiatric problems, not cosmetic problems.
No. And that is why when 30 years ago we were practicing, we had to send our patients first to psychiatric evaluation when they came to change their nose or their eyelids.
But Dr. Saul, that's 30 years ago. We get the sense from Alex Kuczynski that that's not the response of doctors today. They're happy just to do it.
Exactly, because the reward is much higher and the ethics is broken. We are talking about ethics in politics. We are talking about Chen Lei. We are talking about that. But nobody talked about the ethics of medicine.
A fascinating perspective. Alex Kuczynski, how do you respond? Dr. Saul says the ethics are broken here. Doctors should have been sending you and others to a psychiatrist, not to a liposuction lab.
It's actually fascinating because I did interview one doctor who specializes in what she calls foot facelifts, making your feet look as beautiful as, you know, a lifted face.
So they'll look good in those open-toe sandals?
Exactly. And you can look great in your $800 Jimmy Choo's, et cetera. And, you know, she told me she had a patient who came in and demanded liposuction of her big toe. And I said, what did you say? And she said, well, I sent her to a shrink instead. But what is actually very interesting about, the caller is correct in that the ethics of the plastic surgery industry have been really, really shaped in the last 20 years by the fact that they're now allowed to advertise and often do and use public relations agencies. And there's a lot of self-promotion that goes on. And also doctors, when they look at patients, you know, I've attended a lot of plastic surgery seminars and conventions, and every time I've gone to a panel on ethics actually is a code word which translates into choosing the right patient. Rather than say, you know, I talked this woman out of having something to do, the doctors often say, I elected not to treat this patient because I could see that she or he was going to become a problem later. So I advise you, other doctors, to do the same.
A problem later, such like what sort of problem? That they would realize it had been unnecessary, or they wouldn't like the shape of their nasal?
Doctors weed out the patients with what they weed out the patients who they think will come back and say, this isn't perfect. This isn't exactly what I wanted, you know. And And so they choose patients who they believe will actually say, "Ah, I'm satisfied with this result." Sometimes that doesn't happen. Yeah, I interviewed a doctor in California who said, "You know, doctors out there often do perform a PWB before surgery." And I said, "What's that?" And he said, "The positive wallet biopsy." You know, which leads to again a kind of perfect storm.
How deep is the cash here?
Yeah, exactly, because then you can go on forever.
But this is a long way from what our caller, a former surgeon, is saying. You know, doctors should be just essentially saying, advising you to go off and get a mental consult, not a physical one.
Right. I mean, I think that that's not a bad idea. I mean, I don't think I have psychiatric problems, and I don't think I ever suffered from body dysmorphic disorder. I think mine was just a kind of a mania for retaining youth, a small mania, as it were. And I certainly wasn't psychotic. I think he used that adjective. But it's something to think about, and actually doctors should suggest it.
I wish you'd read a little bit for us from maybe here on page 202 where you're talking about your relationship with your Dr. Michelle, as you came to call her, first name relationship, and it got pretty intimate here. Could you read just a bit so we can get a flavor for this interaction?
My relationship with Dr. Michelle, my reliance on her, very slowly deepened into something that resembled addiction. We had an established routine. Come into the office and put on a little Emla cream, a topical lidocaine solution that numbs the skin. Put on a robe and go into room number one, where Dr. Michelle would go over my face with a microdermabrasion tool, a fine sandblaster that sprays tiny crystals across the face, simultaneously abrading and suctioning off the dead skin cells. Perusing my face, she might find a couple of red veins or an area of redness to zap with an intense pulsed light laser, which cauterizes veins and wounds the skin, stimulating the production of new collagen. There might be milia, hard nodules of fat and protein, to be excised. She would then slather my face with a black goo, which she zapped off with another laser. A nurse would clean me up and occasionally slather on more goo, this time a clear coupling gel, for another laser, again to restore collagen to the underlying structures of my face. Dr. Michelle would run it over my face, each wave of light snapping like an elastic band against my skin. We would think up other things to do. My upper lip might be looking a little thin. So over the years, we tried two or three things to plump it up. Nothing trashy looking. Subtle. We tried collagen derived from cadavers. The effect was good, but it disappeared in about 2 weeks. Ditto with the collagen derived from fetal foreskin cells. I wanted to try a form of hyaluronic acid available in Europe called Juvederm because Dr. Michelle seemed enthusiastic about it. I paid my friend Nancy $150 to buy me a tube while she was on vacation in Italy. Hyaluronic acid is used in eye surgery and to treat joint pain in athletes, among other things. She brought it back in a paper envelope from an Italian pharmacy. I enlisted a dermatologist to inject me with it in a few places. Dr. Michelle's enthusiasm waned once she saw me clutching a travel-worn paper bag. And the effect was good. It lasted a few months. I got Botox at least twice a year in the corners of my eyes, where crow's feet form, in the wrinkles across the top of my forehead, in the wrinkles between my eyebrows. Dr. Michelle was always cautious and prudent. "Can't we use it here?" I asked her, pointing to the rings that are a natural part of the skin of the neck. "Don't be crazy," Dr. Michelle said. The visits could last as long as 2 hours. After the entire process was over, I would pay the bill, often somewhere around $1,800. Leave her office, occasionally clutching a blue ice pack to my lip or my forehead, and stagger down Fifth Avenue, hoping no one saw me and wondering, was it wrong to pay my mortgage late so I could get some Botox?
Alex Kuczynski, reading from a book, Beauty Junkies. Here we go, a litany, a relationship that began when she was 27 years old. What are we doing here? Sue's calling from New Haven, Connecticut. Hi, Sue, you're on the air.
Hi, I just had a quick comment. I'm a healthy adult woman struggling to stay healthy and have a healthy self-image of myself.
Yeah.
I eat well. I exercise. I feel okay about my body. I do everything I can short of plastic surgery.
Good for you. How's it going? Is it good enough?
It's a daily struggle. it's a daily struggle because it's hard to work out and keep eating well and maintain that lifestyle when you have this allure of a quick fix. And then also the clothes available for average, quote unquote, women are really not made for average women. So you have all these negative responses to your, you know, attempt at being positive about your body.
Do you feel like you're being herded toward cosmetic surgery and liposuction somehow by these demands, Sue?
Well, I always in the back of my head feel like it's an option. And I just, you know, I really struggle with it. I don't want to have liposuction, but I feel at one point it may be my only hope for thin thighs.
Alex, what do you say to Sue? You've been down this road. So what's your advice?
Well,
you hear Sue, where she stands.
I mean, Sue sounds like a woman just like me. I mean, I was and still am, you know, I try to get enough sleep. You know, I work really hard. There's not enough time in the day to do all the things that you want to do in your professional career and also take care of yourself in a way that, you know, retains this kind of youthful incandescent glow we all had when we were 18 and didn't realize it. And, you know, I hear what Sue is saying about, you know, the way clothes fit. You know, we're now in an age when, you know, clothing stores offer size 00, which is, you know, a philosophically challenging size. You know,
yes.
what are you? You know,
less
a ghost? Are you a non-existent person? And it's very difficult. I mean, you know, again, the pressures to you know, stay thin, stay athletic, drink your pomegranate juice, take your vitamins.
But what do you say after all your experience? Here's Sue. She's saying she's doing all the right stuff. She still feels up against it. She's tempted. Do you say go there or stay right where you are, Sue? You're fine as nature, exercise, and a good diet make you.
Well, you know, I don't know Sue. I'd have to look at her butt first and tell
you. Oh, boy, the pressure's on.
I mean, you know, what's interesting about my book is that I'm not, you know, I'm not a Luddite in terms of medicine and technology. I mean, I do believe that there are certain things that can be accomplished with cosmetic surgery. I mean, there have been studies that show that people who have had a small amount of cosmetic surgery are happier than people who don't. On the other hand, there have been studies that show that women who have breast augmentations commit suicide more frequently than women who don't, et cetera, et cetera. These are all very complicated studies to sort of to digest and get at the very nugget of truth. But in Sue's case, you know, who knows? I mean, I'm an intelligent person, and yet I feel every day I am happier because I don't have to maneuver my face in this dramatic way to get my upper eyelids to open.
Because you had that surgery. Sue, what do you think?
Yeah.
Given the temptation, the kind of pull and expectations on people, do you think you're going to make it through this earthly course without cosmetic surgery, or will you too eventually?
I'm not against it. I feel like for me it will be a last-ditch effort. I still have a while before I'm ready to make that last-ditch effort decision. But I think it's an uphill battle for a lot of women.
And it's out there. It's out there as an option. Sue, thanks very much for your call. Alex, I want to ask you, you write early on in the book, you say we live in a terrifying culture. I mean, I tried to follow through the book, the sort of things driving. You say doctors are driving people to this, but then there are pressures inside. There's the pressure to be economically successful, especially when people are jumping from job to job over many years, and you've got to kind of look, you know, young, eager beaver at each job. And then there's the dance of the sexes today, and there you say we live in a 15-second culture, or you're quoting a friend here, I guess, or somebody. Mm-hmm. That's how long it takes, I believe, for a man to look at you and decide if he will be in love with you. Is that what this is all about?
Well, you know, that's I'm quoting a surgeon there. You know, we do live in an age of the image. I mean, we, as Americans, we move now much more often than our relatives did, our parents and our grandparents. We change jobs more often. We change cities more often. And so our image is our calling card rather than, you know, our lifelong reputation, where we knew the same people over the course of a lifetime. And that image is a very important one. I mean, if you look at, you know, presidents, I mean, who was the last obese president we had? Warren Harding. That was
a while
long
back
time ago.
Yes.
You know, there were rumors that John Kerry had Botox during the last, you know, presidential election. And there are now, you know, rumors that Hillary Clinton has had, you know, a whole boatload of procedures, which I actually don't believe. But, you know, it's fascinating that we really, as Americans, depend on the outer carapace to send the message of whether or not we are good and moral. And study after study after study show that people look at attractive people and say, that person is better and more moral than this person, the unattractive one. They get fewer speeding tickets. They get lighter jail sentences. They get better evaluations as college professors. Mm. It's an amazing thing, but this has been happening for, you know, the last 20 years.
And you quote this doctor more or less saying, a man won't love you or even give himself a chance of falling in love with you if you have a bunion peeping out of your $500 evening sandal. And you're thinking to yourself, tough town. Let me ask you a very personal question. You're married to a multimillionaire super investor. Mm-hmm. Did your 10 years of cosmetic surgery win you that? Is that what this is about?
God, that is a personal and interesting question. You know, I would say no, shockingly. When I met my husband...
Had you had any cosmetic procedures before you met your husband?
You know, I had my eyes done and my lipo after I met him. And when I met him, I felt like I was kind of pudgy and I had sort of slightly brassy blonde hair. And
so you met him before you procedured up. And did you win him before that, or was that part of a campaign?
You know, he is very funny. No, it was not. But it's funny because when we met and he said, oh, my God, I've fallen madly in love with you. I said, oh, that's great. And I thought, you know, I feel pretty confident in my looks. I would certainly change a few things. I had had some Botox, for sure. But we met and he said, my gosh, I'm so in love with you. Why, if you were dipped in a vat of acid and had no arms and legs, I would still love you. And I said, really?
Don't
and
then be he a said, sucker.
And I said, well, my goodness. And then he said, why? Why, I'd even love you if you had cellulite, which was the, like, possibly, you know. So I realized at that moment, okay, we're getting back to reality, buddy. You know, really, cellulite was a lot worse than me being dipped in a vat of acid and having no arms and legs. You know, and you know, my husband is a very athletic guy, so I think that he equates cellulite with some sort of moral, you know, turpitude where you don't exercise every day.
Boy, oh boy, but he knows the word. He knows what it is. And even at the very beginning, it was out there on the table. So in a way, it's not surprising that sooner or later you're down there at the lipo stand.
Well, it's funny. You know, I actually, on the week before our wedding, I sent him to try Botox. And I said, you should try this at least once. And he came home with his eyes wide open and, you know, with this look of permanent terror on his face. And I said, oh, my God, are you okay? And he said, yeah, I had it done. How do I look? And I said, can't you relax your face? He said, no, I can't. I can't. It was a joke, but it was very funny.
Let's take a call from La Jolla, California. Maureen is on the line. Hi, Maureen. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling about the changing financial structure of plastic surgery. My secretary, who is a single mom and so responsible and careful about money, decided she wanted to start dating again, had lipo, and got into deep credit card debt because she used that to pay for her lipo. And I was surprised because this was someone who was so careful and responsible up until that point.
And what do you think drew her to even to go deep into debt to do this? Is it that necessary, that important?
Well, it was surprising because she had lost weight and she was about a size 10, which is pretty much right in the bell curve for an American woman. But there's this pressure to look even better. And some other people in our office had had some breast enlargement. And all of a sudden, it seems like we're the regular, you know, a secretary, this is an option now. It's not just for rich people.
It's amazing. Alex, you write that you can even get bank loans now to do body work.
Oh, yeah. I mean, two-thirds of the people in the United States who get cosmetic surgery like that come from households with incomes less than $50,000. And the reason that's so is because many, many, many banks across the country will now offer loans for cosmetic surgery. As this caller pointed out, you can put it on your credit card and go deep into debt. There are, you know, on plastic surgeons' websites, legitimate plastic surgeons' websites. There are often links to, you know, loan agencies that will give you the money. And may I add that the interest rates on these kinds of loans are extremely high, often as high as 25%. I mean, I'd rather owe the mob some money than owe 25% on a loan for something like that.
And what about the dating game? Maureen raises it again. I mean, we talk some about incentives here, but what about expectations? I mean, have we come to the point where in all those images you describe of celebrities, many, most of whom have had work done, and now just the girl next door has had work done, can you get into the dating market without work and still look, you know, in the game?
You know, I'd love to say, yeah, we live in a perfect world and people can peer inside and see the beauty of our souls every day. But unfortunately, we don't. And we live in a world where it's very easy, as this woman's secretary did, to go out and sign up for cosmetic surgery and believe that that's a sort of magic tonic to attract a mate. I mean, I feel bad for this person because she was a size 10. She had lost weight. She wanted to get back in the dating game. But again, we're surrounded by – I mean, you know, if you've ever seen one of the reality shows about, you know, cosmetic surgery makeovers, you know, they make, you know, a whole raft of procedures and 6 months of surgery look like, you know, 2 days in a hospital bed and suddenly you're, you know, Cheryl Teagues at the height of her beauty. And a lot of people sort of fall prey to that notion that it's very easy, that it's an overnight solution, and it's never an overnight solution. Mm.
Maureen, in La Jolla, down by San Diego, raises breast implants as one of the things that got looked at there. You write some about that. I wish you'd read about it. Here's a place where expectations and frequency, I mean, it just dawns so often now that it sort of seeps into our basic understanding of how a woman ought to look. Could you read us a little bit from that section of Beauty Junkies?
Undoubtedly, the widespread embrace of implants and the public acknowledgement that fake is fine are tied to the strange quirks of male sexuality. If large breasts, quote-unquote, counted only if they were God-given and therefore implants failed to arouse sexual ardor, it's unlikely women would ever get them. But the craze for implants has proven that some men are more aroused by visual cues than by tactile ones. Enough men seem to perk up whether the breasts that poke out of the Victoria's Secret camisole are real or synthetic. In fact, many men have grown to prefer implants, at least unconsciously. Implants, after all, create a female body type that rarely exists in nature, but thrives in the pages of comic books, in video games, and on websites. Huge breasts, wasp waists, gently curved hips, and a high, bubble-shaped butt. It's the look of a Lara Croft, simultaneously muscular and soft and slender and swollen, a hard body with breasts that is radically different from the ideal of the bosom-obsessed 1950s, a fantasy of lushness embodied by Marilyn Monroe and Jane Mansfield. Hourglass women had fleshy hips, meaty thighs, and generous derrières, along with their overflowing brassieres. But today's vogue for extreme thinness makes that model déclassé. How to solve the problem of breasts disappearing with all the other body fat when one's BMI falls low enough for one to fit into that Marc Jacobs dress? To many, implants are the perfect logical fit.
Alex Kuczynski reading from her book Beauty Junkies. And here you raise this issue of body image. And, of course, as you say, the media transmits it everywhere now. Is it possible that what we've come up with, that sort of Lara Croft body, is just an unattainable aspiration without intervention? Have we sort of followed, you know, cosmetic surgery right out of the natural realm?
Well, certainly. I mean, I've been to the Victoria's Secret fashion show and sat in the front row, and those are not normal bodies. I mean, I would say, judging by my eye, that those are women who are starved, who really do have body mass indexes below a healthy weight. I mean, really at like 13, with large fake breasts, and it's a strange combination of a boyish bottom, slim-hipped, and yet a large top that gives them this kind of wobbling sort of pose. And, you know, what most American women don't realize, and really what I wanted to point out in my book, is that, you know, there I am sitting in the front row of the Victoria's Secret fashion show, and those models have cellulite. You know, I've interviewed famous movie actresses, and I won't say who, but as part of an interview with one of them, you know, we were changing in a dressing room, and I looked at her, and she has cellulite.
Not airbrushed, right there.
Not airbrushed. It was right there. And, you know, I think that – and it was something that helped me say, you know, hey, I got to stop this. Who cares? You know, because even this most famous actress in the world – you know, is imperfect, is in fact, you know, would walk down the street in any city in the country and feel imperfect herself. And you know, the secretary in California, I wish she knew that, you know.
And yet most of us don't live in that locker room or that front row at the catwalk. We see the airbrushed image. Let me get a call from Woodlands, Texas. Daryl's on the line. Hi, Daryl. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to pose sort of a, I guess, kind of getting back to the ethics and the culture that was discussed a little bit earlier, and a little bit of what was just touched on in the reading from the book. But I would just like to hear some opinions on what we think is happening with the natural beauty. Whatever happened to that natural beauty? What got us to where everyone wants to be plastic and...
Sounds like we may have lost Daryl, but you get the point there. You write, Alex, about you know, breasts that don't recline when their owners do.
Right.
You know, what happened to that?
I think that as part of contemporary culture, we have grown to sort of become enamored of the artificial. I read the most interesting study a couple of years ago about how Americans preferred – it was a study in which odors were released in a room and American consumers had to choose which odor they liked.
Yeah.
And time again, they chose the artificial pine scent over the scent of natural pine, you know, the artificial rose scent over the scent of the real rose. It's as if we've grown accustomed to a world of artifice and expect that. And in a strange way, it's almost a way for us to subconsciously say, ah, we are technologically triumphant over nature.
We're in control.
We're in control. I mean, it's something that, I mean, ever since the 12th century when the first eyeglasses were invented, it was a way for, it was the first moment at which humanity could say, I trump biology. I conquer thee, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think the same thing happens with cosmetic surgery.
More easily attained now, but it goes way back. You quote William Butler Yeats, no less, at 73 years of age when he wrote, "You think it horrible that lust and rage should dance attendance upon my old age." And you remind us that as he was writing that, he was trying to restore his physical power, youthful vigor, and sexual virility by injecting himself with secretions from monkey glands. And that's that's a ways back.
That is a ways back, but that was a popular way to, quote-unquote, restore youthful vigor. I mean, it's akin to a guy taking Viagra or having hair implants today.
Oh, boy, how far does this go? Maria's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Maria. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. What do you know, Maria?
Well, the comment I like to make is I'm from Brazil, and every time I go down back there, they all incent me to get something done. I mean, it's from any social level, any age, people always get something done, you know, Botox or liposuction. And I'm a 45-year-old, I'm a runner, and I feel great about myself.
Yeah.
But every time I get home, somebody will tell me, you should do this, you should do that, or for your birthday, that's what you should get. So I think it's a very funny topic. And, you know, I just believe it. As long as you're good with yourself, how do you feel, that's what's important. I don't believe on that.
Maria, are you saying that in Brazil it's even more common than what you're seeing in the United States?
Oh, absolutely. It's much more spread, and people do get in debt, and they do everything just for their appearance, you know, just to get it done and look good.
Maria, thanks very much for your call. Let me take another one, if I may, from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. We've got a call from Jane. Hi, Jane. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Because I'm 52 years old,
okay.
And this past August, I had an eye lift, and I had my bags removed, and I feel fabulous. And my point of view now, of course, I was trepidatious beforehand, and I had... you know, some second thoughts.
Right.
But now I'm just so happy. I went to the mirror yesterday to comb my hair at work. Before my operation, I couldn't wear makeup anymore because, you know, my lids were sagging and my bags, and I had makeup on, and I literally, you know, sort of stepped back. I said, look at my eyes. They look beautiful again.
So it really worked. When Alex writes, she writes, inevitably time's winged chariot will catch up to you and march all over your face. You've put that off or turned back that clock, it sounds like.
Well, she's right. I would wake up in the morning and I felt like I had been beaten up by gravity. I'd have these huge bags. My eyes were all distorted. And I felt terrible. And I did this procedure. It was like taking a wart off my nose. If you had a wart on your nose, you wouldn't leave it.
Beaten up by gravity, and now you're on the other side of it, and we can hear the pleasure in that. Let me get another call here, if I may, Alex. We have so many who want to join you from Providence, Rhode Island. Mike is calling. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. What do you know?
I just wanted to give a little different perspective. I'm a 21-year-old college senior, and I'm planning on getting rhinoplasty in a couple months.
What is rhinoplasty, Mike?
Rhinoplasty is getting my nose broken, essentially, and restructured.
A nose job, okay.
Yeah, a nose job. It's been crooked for about as long as I could remember. And when I kind of look at myself in the mirror, I say, you know, this isn't me. I don't feel like I'm myself because the nose is just not the way it's supposed to be. And when we were talking about, when you were talking about artifice earlier.
Yeah.
And I feel, when we're talking about how we're kind of obsessed with things that are artificial, I'm kind of trying to go back to what is actually naturally me.
So are you telling your friends and family? Is it that easy these days, or is it a secret?
And no, that's the kind of, the funny part is that I've really only told my family, and I mentioned it to one of my friends, and he was a little surprised about it.
Mike, let us pick it up. Our time grows short here. Alex, there you go, three in a row. Maria says, hey, in Brazil they do a lot more. And then our good caller says she's delighted at 52 to have this. And Mike says he's about to step up to a nose job but can't tell his family yet.
I think the thing that's so intriguing about the last two callers is that our second caller said she had, you know, she stepped back from the mirror. She was so happy.
Yeah.
It was like having a wart removed. You know, the third caller said he had a crooked nose for as long as he remembered and he wanted to return to the real me. Both of those things, both of their comments point to the medicalization of imperfection. You know, it is now, you know, it's not like having a wart removed. A wart is actually a canker on your body, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Having your eyes done is, yes, a simple procedure, but, you know, we're at this very dangerous point where we're about to medicalize ugliness or imperfection. And, you know, if a crooked nose or, you know, droopy eyelids are, you know, deemed to be medically wrong somehow, then, you know, where do we stop? I mean, we're already prescribing human growth hormone to short children. You know, if you're unhappy, you take antidepressants. You know, if your legs are too short, you can have leg lengthening surgery. If your hair's not thick enough, you can have new hair put in. I mean, at what point does the natural aging process cease to become anything but natural?
You know, perspective, it's kind of Emersonian, and yet I can imagine listeners hearing it from you and saying, well, fine, you've got your millionaire husband and 10 years of cosmetic surgery already behind you. Have you really signed off for the rest of your life?
Well, you know, I would only say that, you know, I'm measuring any sort of thoughts about this in very serious ways. I think there are some things I can confidently say I will never do.
Such as?
I will never have breast implants. I think it's just a completely barbaric and frightening procedure. And I interviewed a lot of doctors who said, you know, you're signing up for a lifetime of surgeries. You know, unless I have breast cancer, and I hope I don't, and have to have reconstructive surgery, and that's an entirely different case.
So that's off. Anything else off the table?
You know, I don't think I'll have liposuction again. I mean, I'm a really fit person, and I think I did address the issue that bothered me about the fat on my posterior. But
once and done, maybe.
Yeah, but I must say that, you know, the eyes, you know, I looked at them the other day and I thought, wow, it's great. They're so pretty again. But I can see them drooping just a little. And I wonder, will I have to do that again someday?
It never goes away. No. Alex Kuczynski, we thank you for the intimate tour of this waterfront. Fascinating. Thanks for sharing with us.
Thank you.
Alex Kuczynski, her new book is Beauty Junkies. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with available real-time traffic monitoring. More information at Acura.com.